The phrase, or clause, is it a clause or a phrase? Needs no introduction, is often used, and normally, to be fair, it's a cliche and it's misused, but in this case, it couldn't be more apt. Michael Rosen is known and loved by millions of adults and children. He's a prolific writer and broadcaster. He has hundreds of books to his name, quite literally. And he's also a passionate advocate of a humane education system and of the importance of the subject of English within that. That's evidenced by all of his work, by his support and work in schools, by support of Nate and Late, and by his regular letters to Mr. Gove in The Guardian, and his fascinating blog, which I'm sure many of you follow. If I can be anecdotal for 1 second before I invite Michael up, I've loved his work for my 2 decades in English teaching, but it probably wasn't until last year, when I had my first child, that I realised just what the power of this man is. If you are a parent, you'll know what I go through when I hear the word again, when I've read, we're going on a bear hunt for 5 times. So, and I know it's the words, not the pictures, because she wouldn't let me get out of the car last year when the prom was on and Michael was doing the musical version of We're Going on a Bear Hunt. We had to sit in the car for an hour until it was finished. She sees the power of Michael's work, and when I saw the look on her face and when I see the smile that comes up whenever we read that book, it just reinforces to me that this man certainly has a gift, and that he is an advocate of English and English teachers is a fantastic thing for Nate to cling on to. This lecture is one of a series. It's titled the Harold Rosen Lecture Series. It's co-sponsored by the Media Education Association and UKLA, the Literacy Association. It's named in honour of Michael's father, Harold Rosen, who did so much to advocate English teaching and English teachers in his long and illustrious career in London and beyond in the 60s, 70s, 80s and 90s. It's a great pleasure and a real honour and a real privilege, and I hope you'll welcome me in giving Michael Rosen a real Nate welcome this afternoon.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I was asked to write this speech, so I have. I do as I'm told. Not always, but on this occasion, because it was Nate. So it'll be a bit reedy, this one, if that's all right with you. So first, I would like to thank Nate for setting up this Harold Rosen lecture. Harold wasn't shy of writing or talking. Far from it. But he was perhaps reluctant to gather together his thoughts and ideas into an accessible form. I think he thought, and I'm only guessing here, that someone else could or should have done it. I've created a blog in his name, which includes a couple of bibliographies. Various people have suggested putting together some of his key works, including several memorable essays published by Nate. The setting up of this lecture will perhaps spur me on to get this done, or as Harold himself would say to our mother, Connie, must press on, Con. Must press on. Secondly, I must thank Nate for asking me to give this first lecture, in what I hope will be a long series. The tradition of memorial lectures is that they should reflect some aspect of the named person, whether it be their work or their life. I've never hidden the fact that I know something of both. Indeed, there were occasions when we used to do a double act. In the morning, he might give a talk to a gathering much like this one on the meaning of narrative, or the narrative of meaning, or the meaning of meaning, or the narrative of narrative. Anyway, and then in the afternoon, I might be asked to read some poems. Some of my favourite poems feature him, not as Professor Harold Rosen, but as my dad, the old man, the OM, or just Harold, as he rather liked his sons to call him. He would sit at the back of the room, and halfway through my reading a poem, he would shout, "Lies! It's all bloody lies!" So I'll do one now, and we can imagine him right now sitting at the back. In fact, when I get to the end, you can be him. And call out, "Lies! It's all bloody lies!" Both by way of remembering him, but also in the spirit of what he believed in. Argument, discussion, counterculture, and the questioning of received wisdom. So here goes a scene in a flat in Pinner in around 1956. You might find that you'll be able to join in with this. We sit down to eat, and the potato's a bit hot. So I only put a little bit on my fork, and I blow, whoosh, whoosh, till it's cool, just cool, into the mouth. Whoosh, nice. And there's my brother, he's doing the same, whoosh, whoosh, till it's cool. Just, join in, it's cool, just cool, into the mouth, the tricky bit now. Nice. And there's my mum, she's doing the same. Yes, we did come from that sort of a home. Here we go. Till it's cool. Just cool. Into the mouth. Nice. But my dad, what does he do? He stuffs a great big chunk of potato into his mouth, and that really does it. His eyes pop out. He blows, he puffs, he yells, he bobs his head up and down. He even spits a potato onto the plate. And he turns to us and he says, "Watch out, everybody, the potato's really hot." Lies! It's all bloody lies. Thank you, exactly. As John Richmond made clear in his wonderful obituary, Harold's work shifted focus from his early days as a classroom teacher to being a head of department in a South London comp, to being a teacher trainer at what was then Borough Road Training College, to being a lecturer at the Institute of Ed, on to being a professor and head of department, and in retirement pursuing several scholarly interests, as well as gathering together his poems and autobiographical writings. Alongside this, he joined with James Britton and Nancy Martin in the forerunner to NATE, the London Association for the Teaching of English, memorably now written up by the ex-chair of NATE. Please let me recommend to you the London Association for the Teaching of English, 1947 to 67, a history by Simon Gibbons. Plug. In this time, he investigated, that's Harold, not Simon, talked about such matters as poetry in schools, the home languages and cultures of school students, the orthodoxies of the exam system and its criteria, interventions into the English curriculum from central government, language use across all the curricula of secondary schools, not just English, the centrality of narrative in knowledge and learning, or the marginalisation of it in education, the power of storytelling, the functions of language, and the patterns and purpose of autobiography, including his own. Out of all this work, it might seem odd, or churlish, a word that Harold loved, actually, to quote something as far back as 1958, long before he became or even thought of himself as an academic. Thanks, I think, to Simon Clements, who taught at the same school as Harold, the English syllabus devised at Walworth Comprehensive School by the English staff themselves with Harold as head of department has come to light. It contains this passage from 1958. "The teaching of English at Walworth calls for a sympathetic understanding of the pupil's environment and temperament. Their language experience is acquired from their environment and from communication with the people who mean most to them. However narrow the experience of our pupils may be, brackets, and it's often wider than we think, close brackets, it is this experience alone which has given their language meaning. The starting point for English work, must be the ability to handle effectively their own experience. Oral work, written work, and the discussion of literature must create an atmosphere in which the pupils become confident of the full acceptability of the material of their own experience." It's cited in A Curriculum in Its Place, English Teaching in One School, 1946 to 63, by Peter Medway and Patrick Kingwell. Let me recommend that too. They say, in a chattier article from the same year, Rosen writes, quote, "Without hesitation, I would say the home is the first source of supply. Keep sending them home. To mum, to dad, to the family, at meals, quarrelling, having a laugh, getting up, going out, buying something. Then what happens? They're dealing with a situation, rich in first-hand feeling, charged with association and personal relationships, alive with people they know extraordinarily well, down to the last foible." He must have known I was going to write about him. "Because they know and feel about these things that have the language to write about them. The springs of language are being tapped, and all the writing skill can be directed towards the experience. From the home, we can branch out into other autobiographical material, friends, the district, and school." And in Medway and John Hardcastle's 2004 interview with Harold, also cited in the book, Harold talked about a lesson on great expectations, and the first chapter, in which we find, of course, the encounter with Magwitch. "Gimme Whittles, boy." I've been practising that every time Ray Pearson comes on the telly doing the betting thing. "Do you know what a file is?" My son keeps telling me to shut up. He wants to watch the football anyway. "The encounter with Magwitch, the convict, which is a fantastic piece." This is Harold speaking, not me. "I've always thought it was quite incredible. And we read the big chunk, and we read the big chunk in class, of where he gets him to promise he'll bring a file. Do you know what a file is, boy? And something to eat. And so we read it. I read it once, and then I had them read it as a drama, skipping the intervening bits. Just it's full of dialogue, and then we explored the idea of being frightened, and being frightened of certain kinds of adults. Well, I can remember being fantastically chuffed, because they couldn't stop talking about frightening adults. quite different kinds, of course, and I was surprised at how often there were people encountered in the markets who grabbed hold of them and so on, tried to get money from them. And then, of course, they could, if they wanted to, write about that. And they did. And there were a lot of good pieces. As we now know, though, it took the interventions of such people as Kenneth Baker in 1988 and Michael Gove in 2014 to allow all students in comprehensive schools to read Dickens. Or not. Some people here will not only remember some of the things Harold said and wrote, but also the way in which he said them. His provocative questioning, perhaps, or the anecdotes from his childhood classrooms and staff rooms. Of course, as his children, we got another view of it. If you can imagine the way in which a dog harasses an old glove, you might get a sense of it. He would fasten on to a word or a phrase or a whole subject and argue with it out loud. As a teenager, I can remember him sitting at the table with us having our evening meal. He, with papers and books all round him, getting enraged about something called T-units. He was doing his PhD on a system of defining a student's quality of English based on a supposedly objective measure called T-units. Many years later, long after I'd left home, I would come to the house, and almost as I was walking through the door, he'd be offloading his fascination with, say, Bakhtin on subversive laughter, feminist analyses of autobiography, or Frederick Bartlett on memory. In case this conjures up a vision of someone locked hopelessly and helplessly in a prison of theory, I should add that the particular fascination he had to share could just as easily be with the previous week's Arsenal performance, the miners' strike, or the state of mind of the Cats. In more ways than I can know myself, I've learnt from Harold, not only in the what of what he talked about, but also in the how and the why. You all know better than me that his specific area of interest and work, English teaching in schools, is a matter of intense scrutiny and control from politicians. Right up to his death in 2008, we would talk about this. And in some ways, the regimes imposed on English teachers since 1988 represent a defeat of ideas that he and many others believed in. One conversation that I didn't ever have with him, though, perhaps I was worried that it might be too painful, was over the matter of tactics. Let me put it this way. The predecessors of the people in this room believed and acted on the belief that the teaching of English would develop and progress through the active participation of classroom teachers, working hand in hand with university-based teachers. Exciting. Through a network of conferences and the production of papers and books, ideas would be produced, contested, and adapted, but which could be traced back to actual encounters between teachers and school students. And this is the important political bit, this would be enough. It would be self-evident that such teacher-based ideas would have the stamp of reality on them. What's more, in the process of developing these ideas, teachers would be developing themselves as thinkers, as professionals, and as people, enjoying doing the work. What all this missed out, sadly, is the politics of education. That's to say, since at least 1988, politicians in many countries, other than Finland, have taken on the role of knowing more about teaching than those who teach, and more about teaching than those who study teaching. Now, English teaching is particularly susceptible to this kind of intervention because in some ways we are all experts in it. Most of us, under the domain of the British government, speak and write English. It's very easy to make broad, general statements about, let's say, a whole generation of people who, it is suggested, can't write and only speak in grunts. This seems to be the tenor of what Michael Wilshaw likes to say over and over again. The fact that this generation is now in their 20s, 30s and 40s ought to give pause for thought. After all, the supposed failure of the failed generation is often linked without evidence to why Britain is falling behind and failing. Yes, it's true, the thing we were allowed to refer to for a short while as British capitalism did come very close to collapse. But we've been told that the only thing that can save us is lower pay and less money spent on public services. So was this collapse, this failure, caused by bad English teaching or not? I don't know. If Michael Wilshaw is worried about a failed generation and the failings of British capitalism, shouldn't he nip down to the City of London and do some hard questioning of the educational backgrounds of the hedge fund managers, debt sellers, rate fixers and speculators? And then he could apply his findings back to the kinds of schools that these folks came from. And he could perhaps conjure up the kind of educational input he might imagine which would put a check on such people and such activity. But of course, he won't. No. Instead, we get talk about generations being failed by you and your predecessors, linked to what are indeed tough times for many people, tough times for which you are not responsible. But it's more than talk. It's legislation, tests, exams, inspections, and league tables. I don't think anyone, my father included, could have imagined how centralised, how Napoleonic, the Department for Education could become in its micromanaging of syllabuses and teaching methods, even more so now, just in the last few weeks. In short, I'll put this bluntly. Successive governments have behaved as if teachers are too stupid and too lazy to be trusted to think about education. More particularly, English teachers are too stupid and too lazy to know about literacy, language, and literature. Or worse, you have been involved in a conspiracy to deprive those particular children who come from backgrounds where standard English is not regularly written and where the shelves are not laden with great books. The fact that you've repeatedly jumped through the hoops that successive governments have put in front of you, the fact that you've consistently adapted previously held beliefs to fit the requirements of tests, exams, and inspections is ignored. The fact that there is a long line of talks, articles, books, textbooks, and conferences, perhaps dating from those words of my father in 1958, showing an almost obsessive commitment to working class education, is seen as part of the problem and not as part of the solution. The fact that the system now in place more than ever before embeds failure, failure, and more failure at the heart of education is just an inconvenience that we're supposed to overlook. A good deal of this, I think, involves what Freudians call displacement. That's to say, we live in times of panic about the general state of affairs with humanity's ability to cope with real or concocted fears about climate change, war, terrorism, antibiotics, migration, and debt. What politicians are expert at, in fact, I sometimes wonder if they go on special courses to learn how to do it, is to displace these anxieties onto things that are neither the cause or the remedy. One of these is English teaching. And within that, the English language itself. So, for example, I'm beginning to doubt if I can read. After all, I was taught to read without an hour a day's worth of systematic synthetic phonics, implemented according to the principles of first, fast, and only. Even worse, Harold and Connie Rosen read to me every night and shared with me the writing on the pages of Beatrix Potter books and Picture Puffin books, none of which was written according to the approved graded methods of systematic synthetic phonics. Heaven knows how I picked up the alphabetic principle, given that I learnt to read using a multi-queuing system. And so to grammar, or more particularly, the grammar of written English. I don't need to tell you that a grammar syllabus based on the total language use of the students you teach doesn't meet with the approval of those who lay down what you teach. Indeed, the implication at the heart of the guidelines and regulations is that the way many students write and speak is faulty. And presumably, once they've scored less than a C at whatever the exam is to be called at 16, a bit out of touch with that, I'm afraid, I've got a 13-year-old, and how should we know, which will prove that they have failed, they will go out into the world knowing they are faulty users of English. More than that, having been told that everyone should be able to get an A to C grade, or whatever it'll be called, and having not got one, such people will know that they have only themselves to blame. And presumably, whatever setbacks befall them later in life, like, say, being sacked, this too will be their own fault. Well, it's one way to make sure that people, when sacked, go quietly. So if it's not easy, not possible, or if it is highly unlikely that there is time to run a grammar course for under 16s, which has at its heart the student's own language use, spoken and written, is there any wider interpretation of language use which includes, at the very least, the variety of English that students come across? One of the futilities of prescriptive grammar is that it takes as its implied or actual sample the grammar of one specific kind of writing, the writing of continuous non-fiction prose, and within that, single, isolated, out of context, specific sentences. So leaving behind, albeit reluctantly, the varieties of spoken language in use, what happens if we ask ourselves, what varieties of written language in use can we spot? After all, a scientist or a sociologist would take it as read that a given field of study would and should involve spotting varieties, creating distinctions and categories and classifications. So let's put on our anoraks and go language spotting. Better still, let's start with an experiment. You're going to write a puff for the place, road, village, town, city, country, where you come from. Yes? As you wish. This is in order to say that the place in question is a desirable place to visit. This is not the part of the ad which commands your reader to come or to visit. That's in another part of the ad which says things like not to be missed or come to. This is the box inside which you tell us expansively as you can what you've got. One restriction, you've got to do this in 30 words and you can lay it out how you like. Your box of writing can be wide or narrow. You can use letters and punctuation how you like. Okay, so you've got 30 words to boast about the place that you come from. Have you got pencil and paper? Maybe English teachers, there you go. All right, it's very interactive, this, you know. Harold told me, always be interactive, yeah. Okay, so there you go, have a go. 30 words, all right. Or if you get to 15, it's all right. I'm not, you know, linked to ability. This is not one of those, you know, I arrived at a school and the teacher said, I'm not blaming teachers, I promise you. I arrived at this primary school and the teacher said, oh, it's so good you've come, Michael. We're going to do poetry. The older children are writing poems. No, sorry, the quicks, I forget, it's right. The quicks are doing poems and the slows are doing rhyming words. So if the quicks over here, if the quicks would like to do 30 words and the slows do 15, that's fine by me. No, no, that was just silly and I shouldn't have said that. I'm sorry. Okay. No, it is a classic case of what has come about because of things, as we know. Okay, so there you go. Go on, have a little boast about the place you come from. And you don't have to say, come and visit. You're just going to say the lovely things in your street or village or town. There you go. You've only got 30 words max, which is quite a lot. There you go. And you can lay it out how you like, whatever punctuation you like. But you don't have to do the come and visit bit, all right? You don't have to do that bit. You're just saying what you got. It's a bit like a kind of imagist poem about your gaff, your manner. You can do it collectively if you like, with your talk buddy, as Americans call you. Do you know about talk buddies? 30 words max, folks. Yeah, it could be under 30. You've done 29. Well done. Very good. One of the quicks. Good. Just another few secs, just to give you a feel of it. The kind of requirement and the kind of, I'm going to suggest, experimentation that you might be using with punctuation, capital letters. There you go. And perhaps show the person next to you, see what you've done. There you go. If you got to 15, it doesn't matter, it's all right. That will do. Okay. All right. Okay. So you compare what you've done with what I'm about to read to you now, all right? Okay. So this is one I saw on an ad in the London Underground this week. Here we go. Centuries of naval history, comma, waterfront shopping, comma, superb dining, comma, new soaring sights, no comma, and miles of amazing beaches, full stop. Ideally, with a capital I, situated on the beautiful south coast, comma, only 90 minutes from London, full stop. and this was an ad for Portsmouth. This presumably, I think, should fall into the category of defective and incorrect writing. Capital letters and full stops are used here without the phrases or clauses, thank you, John, thank you, Simon, being true and correct sentences. Stylistically, perhaps there are problems with the adjectival present participle soaring and the adverb ideally. It's far from certain how, in a piece of factual writing, a site can be soaring, or why and how this place can be situated ideally. Conveniently, maybe, but not ideally, surely. I may not love this writing, but it's doing its job without finite verbs between its capital letters and full stops. Now, an hour reading ads and notices will reveal hundreds of examples like this. Quite clearly, this world of signs, away from continuous non-fiction prose, operates according to principles not devised in school grammar books. We might ask, who invents these principles? And once invented, how come we're able to read what's written? Just to take the full stop in ad, poster and sign land, it seems to have functions other than those of continuous prose. It can be dropped even when a full so-called true sentence is given to us. In an emergency, new line, use, capital U, the red emergency, new line, button to alert the driver. No full stop. In an emergency, use the red emergency button to alert the driver. In fact, the capital U, but not capital B, has a principle all of its own. I don't know what that principle is, but perhaps best to ask the exec for Transport for London, Boris Johnson, who I know is a stickler for such things. Or the full stop can be used like this. One water, water's got a capital W, full stop. One difference, capital D, full stop. In fact, the more you look at ads, even quite complicated language-dense ones, the more you realise that it's become a kind of playground for graphic designers and copywriters who have, in effect, invented or reinvented ways of writing. Yet, as I say, we can read what they write. I think there are important lessons here. One, that written language is not static, unchanging, and conservative. Two, some very public, appropriate, highly communicative written language does not follow the patterns and conventions of traditional continuous non-fiction prose. Three, some of this very public writing is commercially successful. People make a living inventing it. Firms rely on it in order to sell their products. Four, official bodies and authorities use it in order to pass on messages, some of which are a matter of life and death. Five, when talking about grammar, which is often a synonym for what people imagine is correct grammar, it's uncommon for this kind of writing to be included. Within the terms of correct grammar, it's incorrect, though clearly it's doing its job correctly enough to satisfy people publicising Portsmouth or delivering life and death instructions on London Underground. Six, I think we confuse, baffle and deceive children and school students if we talk about written English as if there is only one way to write it, as if it is static, unchanging and conservative. What do grammarians say about this? R.L. Trask taught linguistics and wrote the Penguin Dictionary of English Grammar. It's arranged along dictionary lines in alphabetical order, listing grammatical terms. So we find here a term I hadn't ever come across before, block language. Do you know about block language? The definition. The distinctive type of language used in public signs, typically consisting of phrases rather than complete sentences. Examples: no parking, left turn only, stage door, EU passports, Birmingham in the north, open Sunday. Compare headline language. We go to headline language. We find the rather special variety of English used in writing newspaper headlines. In the following examples, the first form illustrates headline language and the second ordinary English. President denies misconduct. The president has denied misconduct. Universities feeling the pinch. Universities are feeling the pinch. PM to visit China. The Prime Minister is going to visit China. If, like me, you're obsessive enough to be the kind of person who would read a whole dictionary of grammar, sorry, we find some other terms. The minor sentence. Do you know about the minor sentence? Yes, you know about the minor sentence. This is where a piece of language doesn't have the form of a complete sentence, but I quote, which is normal in context. Examples: why not do it now? Any news? All aboard? No smoking? This way, please? As if I would know. The pro drop. The property of a language in which a sentence does not require an overt subject. Here Trask suggests that English is not a pro-drop language. But then I thought there are plenty of examples of pro-drop in English, but maybe I haven't got the point, as in, say, see you soon. That doesn't seem to have a subject. But anyway, the fragment. Do you know about the fragment? An incomplete piece of a sentence used by itself. Examples: Ted, where's Susie? Mike, in the library. Ted, this is dated year 2000. Can England win the World Cup? Mike, probably not. The pro sentence. A single word which can take the place of a complete sentence. Did you know about that one? The most familiar English examples are, of course, yes and no. Here is an example. Jan, would you like some Tabasco sauce? Spelt mysteriously, T-O-B. All the Tabasco sauce I've ever had spelt with an A. Larry, yes. Here's Larry's response, is equivalent to the sentence, I would like some Tabasco sauce. And, of course, our old friend, ellipsis. The omission from a sentence of material which is logically required to complete its structure. Examples, enough said. Enough said. Seems we have a problem. It seems we have a problem. Which should feature as an example of pro-drop, shouldn't it? I don't. Someone can explain if I got that wrong. Which, according to Trask, doesn't occur in English. Grammarians sometimes are quite muddling. I get muddled. Sorry, do that another way. I sometimes get muddled by what grammarians say. So what should we make of all this? My first reaction is to be mildly delighted. Of course, other grammarians visit this territory. Our hero, David Crystal, gives it a couple of pages in his Rediscover Grammar book. With Trask, we're given more terms than Crystal gives us in that particular handbook, though, of course, they're spread out and diffused through the whole dictionary. There isn't a consistent effort to describe and analyse the kinds of signs and posters that we see and read every day. I have another problem. The usage in question is mostly seen in the light of whatever it is that a complete sentence is. Though, Trask tells us they are normal in context, thank goodness for that, there is the suggestion that lying behind all these signs and utterances are more complete forms. In other words, they are defined in terms of what they are not, rather than what they are. I don't buy this. The first rule of descriptive grammar should start out from the principle of who is doing the speaking or writing, who are they talking or writing for or to. In other words, it has its own force field, if you like, and can only be explained in terms of structures outside that context if it can be shown that they derive from that context. I'm not sure that the examples I've given derive from what Trask calls more complete forms. I think they come from somewhere else. For example, some of the language in question might be described in terms of its proximity to a good deal of speech. Advertising copywriters and signwriters frequently try to imitate the questions, commands and phrases that we use or might use in speech, albeit in very exhortatory get-up-and-go sort of a way. So all the following come from ads and signs in the underground. The command, go miles further with our best ever Skywoods Miles offer. The command. The coax. Let's get it done. The statement that sounds like an answer. Helping London grow for the future. The question as if in speech. Going on a hot date this weekend. That one's from Boris, by the way. Or got an opinion? Then share it with us. The famously ambiguous command that isn't a command. Dogs must be carried. To which we can always reply, but I haven't got a dog. The request, please stand on the right. The statement, as in speech, followed by the informal exclamation. Delays cut by 40%. Whoosh. Another one from Boris, that one. Or TFL, I should say. The pseudo-poetic or proverbial. Cold drink, warm heart. Again, from everyday potentials to future spouse essentials. Followed by announcements. Brands you know, full stop. Rewards you'll love, full stop. Telegram or text message type descriptions. Floor slippery when wet. Punctuation free zone. This is a residential area, please leave quietly. No punctuation. The hidden request or command embedded in the use of to fill, as in 700 empty bowls to fill this Christmas. Or simpler statement but more complex grammatically. Coffee to go. Where I think to go is probably a highly specific adjectival phrase, but which you can only understand if we know US usage. Coffee to go. And even more compact, and with yet another function for the word to, smint. Fresh to impress. Meaning, I think, that it will impress, rather than a command. You will be impressed. or an adjectival description. It is fresh in an impressive way. No, I don't think so. Maybe it would be adverbial, fresh to impress. I don't know. It needs discovering. The right of titles of books, films, plays, songs and poems to use language that implies that something is unfinished, unsaid or indeed incomplete. Appropriately enough, London Grammar, some of you may not know is a band, but they are. London Grammar, if you wait. Inventing new vocabulary. Whole food revosmution, fruits and nuts smooshed together. Invented punctuation. Mortgages, full stop. Courtesy of our savers, full stop. Or even planet, full stop. Sized, full stop. Brain, full stop. The conventions of the press recommendations, including single words, the title of the newspaper, or even just a sign, no language. Dazzling. Metro. Five stars in a row. Evening Standard. A beauty of a show. The Telegraph. And the strangely non-referential. Manchester for just £19. So the for just £19 doesn't refer to Manchester, but the obviously the journey to Manchester. Is anyone here from... No, I won't go on. A different sense to the grammatical term, the dangling participle. Closing down. Everything must go. Where what's being referred to is a place, not the word for a place. It's the shop, yes. Grammatical ambiguity. Lower window for ventilation. Is it a command or a description? Should I lower the window or look for a lower window? Context explains all. I should lower the window. Or similarly, look right. Well, I look fine, thanks. A complex and, dare I say, poetic utterance. Eat up, full stop. Feet up, full stop. Catch up, full stop. Two of which are verbal commands. Eat up, catch up, they're verbs. But one of them, feet up, sounds as if it could be or should be, but is actually a description. So it's a kind of grammatical pun, which we can understand. The feigned correction. It's the thought that counts, where the is crossed out but still visible, so we read both it's the thought that counts and it's thought that counts, involving mistakes, corrections, rewrites, edits, or is it the pseudo-palimpsest, the text written on another text? Another one from Boris. Travel alerts on Twitter, brackets, OMG, exclamation mark. In other words, using a quotation without having to reference it because it's colloquial digital language shared by those that the ad wishes to address. A fine example of what literary theorists call how an implied reader is inscribed in the language of every piece of text. OMG. Highly complex but simple, stop works. Which, as we know, does not mean, say, this bus stop is working or that stopping works generally in life, but that we should stop because there's a building site nearby. Even more simple, but even more complex, stop, written on the button on a bus, where it doesn't mean that we should stop anything or stop doing anything. It means if I want to send a message to the driver to stop the bus, he or she will, but not that he or she will stop the bus immediately. He or she will stop the bus at a bus stop. I can't think of a better example of how language can only fully signify when we know the context. So within the context of ads and signs, a complex range of language use and grammars. Interestingly, I think we learn how to understand them without being told how. We pick them up through looking, reading, rereading, and talking about them with family and friends. I would argue that they offer us in education a rich resource for describing and understanding language in use, which ought to be all one word. If we were Germans, it probably would be. Language in use. I love German. Perfect for words like, for phrases like that. Language in use. People like R.L. Trask give us some of the means by which we can pin this down, but it may well be that we have to invent our own. A truly liberating thing for school students to do, I would say. Now, of course, I am by no means the first person to draw attention to this idea of varieties of written English, and of course, there are many more than the ones that I've talked about so far. Some of you may know Variety in Written English by Tony Bex from 1996, and I would suggest subsequently largely ignored by those who want to tell us how to talk about language to children and students. More technical is Text Types and the History of English by Manfred Gerlach from 2004. Bex reminds us that standard English, even within the context of continuous non-fiction prose, has variety. And he draws attention to such things as the language of letters, informing people of their rights, descriptions of a gas boiler, printed messages on Christmas cards, legal notices, lists of ingredients, Psalm 24 in the King James Bible of 1611, information about lost telephone cards, do you remember them? Recipes, letters, bills, an announcement of a conference on linguistics, notices of sale of second-hand items, a spoof scientific document on temperature and geography, and finally, in a surprisingly short section, poems and novels. Gerlach attempts a classification of text types going back to Old English and forward to such things as hymns, jokes, representation of a standardised dialect in Scots, and what he calls Indian English. In the central section of the book, he has a glossary of, guess how many items of text types? 2,000. Before I look at a few more examples I've collected, let's just stop for a moment and consider how a Minister of Education who was seriously interested in children and students of all ages understanding language, how that minister might behave. With the kind of work done by Bex and Gerlach, a minister might start up a commission under the auspices of NAET, say, in which teachers and teacher educators might develop potential fields of study and investigation for students and teachers to look at in the field of text types or variety of written English. What might be the most appropriate types? What might be the most appropriate terminology? What would most help children and students to understand the language they see, read, and try to use when they're writing? This wouldn't have to be limited and held within what have been called genres. It wouldn't have to be limited by criteria derived from outside language on the basis that one genre is more powerful than another. I know the argument which claims that the language of administration is more powerful than the language of, say, subjective accounts of what I did today. Meanwhile, the language of, say, advertising leads us to believe that the word fat-free indicates that it's healthy, even if the food in question is stacked up with refined sugar. In the previous NAET talk, I suggested that helping students discover the strategies by which people lie when speaking as well as writing. It might be just as powerful as being told that this or that genre is powerful and that you become powerful when I dictate to you how to write like that. A strange contradiction in terms, I've always thought. So let's return to one or two more text types and press on. Text types. The press are often on teachers' backs for failing to instill what they often call the rules of English. Here's the sports writer Patrick Barclay writing in the Evening Standard on June the 23rd this year. There was no shilly-shallying, no retraction that time would be taken to absorb the lessons, brackets, in other words, comma, assess the determination of the media to have a head on a plate, close brackets, full stop. Just a grasp of the international game, full stop. And it will get better, full stop. The phrase, just a grasp of the international game, is given a capital letter at the beginning and a full stop at the end. Likewise, and it will get better. What's going on here? This is the development of standard English writing going on at this very moment. As we can tell from the phrases, no retraction that time would be taken, or a clause, and assess the determination of the media, Barclay is a writer who can draw on highly formal ways of writing. And yet he's quite happy to break what children and students will be told is a rule about sentences, and indeed marked on it in tests and exams. In short, you here are required to fib to children that there is only one way to write continuous non-fiction prose in standard English. Clearly, even the sub-editors at the Evening Standard were quite happy for Patrick Barclay to write like that. In other words, there is a new, what shall we call it, informal formal writing. Any curriculum based on language in use, all one word, would enable students to find, investigate, and write about a development like this. I would suggest that we don't even really know why or how it has come about. Interestingly enough, it's come about at precisely the time when the bookshops are full of books by people like John Humphreys, Simon Heffer, or the ubiquitous Gwynne, telling us that correct writing should look like. Again, something to investigate. Meanwhile, like Tony Bex, I've left the best till last. Swallows? Dark air, life looping, yet missing the pure loop. A twitch, a twitter, an elastic shudder in flight, and serrated wings against the sky, like a glove, a black glove thrown up at the light and falling back. Never swallows. Bats. D.H. Lawrence, Bat, 1923. Many of you will know the layout on the page, done according to the principles of free verse, namely that the line breaks are guidelines to how the poet would like us to read it. Some people have said the line in a free verse poem is the equivalent of the foot in a metrical poem. It is the marriage of a unit of sense with a measured out unit of language. With Lawrence, as with thousands of other poets, he writes in what appears to be a standard form of language, other than that he doesn't, in this section, use finite verbs. He bounces between questions, descriptions, and exclamations. He not only uses exclamation marks, but also italics with exclamation marks, a kind of double exclamation then. He uses double line breaks as if there are verses or stanzas. He uses them irregularly. He uses traditional capital letter system at the beginning of lines for, I suspect, no other reason than that he wanted to call this kind of writing poetry. He uses repetition, done as we used to call it, in apposition, listing terms, adding descriptions as he goes. It's hard to resist the temptation to say the lists gather descriptions to give the impression of the looping of the flight of the swallow. A musician will explain that if you say a twitch, a twitter, a shudder, there is no change in the tempo. If you add in elastic but keep the beat and squeeze in the extra words, you speed up the speech to fit the beat. Thus, a twitch, a twitter, an elastic shudder. Poetry and poetry with music, as with rap, can teach us how to do these things, and we can unpack it grammatically to see how it was done. Lawrence didn't invent this kind of writing. Let's try Shakespeare. Hamlet is in quite a state. He wonders whether it's worth going on. He says to die, to sleep, no more. And by asleep, to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep, perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. This is, of course, written speech, another text type. Grammatically, Shakespeare has written this part of the to be or not to be speech with what Trask has named as minor sentences and fragments. Though the first part of the speech that I've quoted, which you all know, is enclosed with full stops, the first finite verb in sight in this is the colloquial tis. And then off we go with the inversion of to die, to sleep, and there's the rub. You could perhaps put up an argument that grammatically the whole thing refers back to be or not to be. That is the question. But either way, this soliloquy is what some people might foolishly call highly irregular. But we don't call it highly irregular. We call it Shakespeare. Or a great speech. What we can do, though, is investigate it. We can see if grammarians have given us ways of describing what we find, or if perhaps we need some new ways. We can see if, looking into it, this releases some meanings that we hadn't thought about before. So we might see that the grammar is different from the first part of the speech. To be or not to be, that is the question, whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune or to take up arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. This part sounds coherent. It's written in standard grammar, subject-verb, alternative but equal clauses as subject. This involves a classical balance of opposites with a view to possible consequences, all very rational. Do we say that the grammar produces the rationality, or that the rationality produces the grammar? Interesting question, I've no idea. We might say that the passage with the minor sentences and fragments represents a process where Hamlet's rational thought and standard grammar break up. Could we say the passage gives us another kind of thought process? The ruptures, self-questionings and self-interruptions of inner speech, or what we think sounds like inner speech. Again, do we say that the grammar produces the impression of confusion, or the impression of confusion produces the grammar, or perhaps both? That's a question to ask a writer, and I get from that that it's something that we can invite students to try themselves. We can say, can you convey in writing a slide from coherent thought into confusion? One minute you're planning for your GCSEs, and the next minute you slide into panic. How do you write that? On the other hand, the other way round, one moment you think of your parents in a state of rage, you're with the rage, or they are, or both, and the next you have an insight into what kinds of childhoods that they had, and this enables you to make allowances for them. We can investigate what kind of grammatical constructions we find ourselves using in order to do that, and we can make comparisons between what and how we write with how Shakespeare wrote that passage. And finally, we can take a well-known passage from a novel. Some of you will know it well. Fog everywhere. Full stop. Fog up the river where it flows among green eights and meadows. Fog down the river where it rolls defiled among the tiers of shipping and the waterside pollutions of a great and dirty city. Fog on the Essex marshes, fog on the Kentish heights, fog creeping into the cabooses of collier brigs, fog lying out on the yards and hovering in the rigging of great ships, fog drooping on the gunwales of barges and small boats, fog in the eyes and throats of ancient Greenwich pensioners wheezing by the firesides of their wards, fog in the stem and bowl of the afternoon pipe of the wrathful skipper down in his close cabin, fog cruelly pinching the toes and fingers of his shivering little prentice boy on deck, chance people on the bridges peeping over the parapets into a nether sky of fog, with fog all round them as if they were up in a balloon and hanging in the misty clouds, gas looming through the fog in divers places in the streets, much as the sun may from the spongy fields be seen to loom by husbandman and ploughboy, most of the shops lighted 2 hours before their time, as the gas seems to know, for it has a haggard and unwilling look. The raw afternoon is rawest, and the dense fog is densest, and the muddy streets are muddiest, near that leaden-headed old obstruction, appropriate ornament for the threshold of a leaden-headed old corporation, Temple Bar. And hard by Temple Bar in Lincoln's Inn Hall, at the very heart of the fog, sits the Lord High Chancellor in his High Court of Chancery. Never can there come fog too thick. Never can there come mud and mire too deep to assort with the groping and floundering condition which this High Court of Chancery, most pestilent of hoary sinners, holds this day in the sight of heaven and earth. This piece of writing defies the neat categories we like to give to literature. It is descriptive, poetic, and figurative. It's social in that it shows us a range of social class, but it's also political, or engagé, as the French would say, and ultimately passionate and angry. This range is represented in the grammar, which begins with the syntax of a free verse or prose poem, short descriptive strokes as if it had been written by one of the imagists, T. Hume or H.D., extends into phrases with present participles as it includes people at work, and ends with complete sentences sculpted into patterns of repeated finite clauses, piling on top of each other, just as a political speaker or priest might use to grab and hold the attention of an audience. Incidentally, the first part of this passage uses a dance of punctuation between full stops, commas and semicolons, employed apparently arbitrarily by Dickens, unless we can detect a subtle attempt to mark pauses between cadences as a composer might do with minim rest, semi-breves and breves. Why not? The term standard English cannot contain writing like this. Nor should it. It's the job of grammar to describe what writers and speakers do. It's not the job of writers and speakers to do what grammarians or politicians tell us to do. I'll finish with a Harold-like suggestion. Perhaps we can take Trask, Tony Beck's, and Manfred Gerlach, along with, say, Michael Toulon's language in literature, and break their work down into something accessible for 10-year-olds or 14-year-olds, which would enable them to investigate, not enforce, varieties of English in use. Yes, Ronald Carter and his colleagues have produced books in that zone, but I'm suggesting something simpler and, dare I say, more fun than that. Perhaps Nate could produce a resource for teachers and students like that. And while I'm on that, has Nate ever thought of asking, say, 20 published writers about how and why they write? And what suggestions would those writers give to students and teachers on how to do it? If not, no worries, that's another idea for another time. Harold always believed there was another idea for another time. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Yesterday, I finished the first year of my teacher training, and today I'm thanking Michael Rosen, so it doesn't get much more intimidating than that. Unless, of course, you follow the instructions of my year 8 class yesterday, who, when I told them what I was going to do, said, "Miss, don't make a show of yourself, he's on a book." Another idea for another day, perhaps. Thank you, Michael, on behalf of myself and everybody else. Food for thought, indeed.